He's experienced the complete range of emotions, both on the racetrack and off. A two-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, he was on top of the racing world in 1994 when he won a second race at the Speedway. He dominated the circuit that year and appeared destined to catch up with his uncle and father for 500 victories. But everything went wrong in 1995 when he failed to qualify for the race, and the split between the IRL and CART in 1996 took a major toll on his psyche as well. His career and life spiraled downward from that point. He lost his marriage, and his daughter became paralyzed in 1999, and he began fighting a losing battle with alcohol. But he won that one too, and now is riding high once again as a mentor to young drivers and an example to alcoholics. I'm Mark Monteith, and once again, I'm going one-on-one with Al Unser Jr.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever. Pita Pit, have you had your pita today?
So how does Al Unser Jr. celebrate winning his first Indy 500? Do you remember? Do you do anything special, or are you just too tired to do anything?
Definitely not tired. You know, we were definitely running on adrenaline, and it was a wonderful feeling. I mean, we had some drinks and just kind of sat back and just kind of soaked it in. You know, what can you say? I mean, I had friends came up, you know, keep coming up and telling me, "You won the Indy 500." You know, and then when my friends weren't around, I'd be thinking, I won the Indy 500, and it was a great feeling.
Yeah, and what's Dad's reaction to that?
I remember getting in the pace car when you're taking the pace lap and going down pit lane. My dad ran third that day in '92, and so he was in the race, and he could have very well won it too. He was extremely fast that day, and he was in the Buick, and it was the highest finishing that the Buick ever finished during its time here at Indy. His arms, he was down near pit end, his arms were so big to give me a hug. They were just huge. They were just open, and the grin on his face. I mean, he was just a proud father.
Yeah.
And I was a very proud son, and it was strong. It was great.
How about Uncle Bobby?
Uncle Bobby, he was up in the booth, and so he was.
That's right. He was helping broadcast.
He was doing the broadcast, and so on TV afterwards, you know, I heard the excitement that Uncle Bobby had, and it was very, very proud.
I know he talked about how he had to try to keep it cool on the broadcast, you know, be objective, but he certainly didn't feel that way.
It didn't work. You know, I thought he was really excited because he had to do it because he was up in the booth in '87 when Dad won. And so he was very proud of my dad winning in '87. And he kind of, it sounded the same to me, you know, from '87 to '92. He was happy,
yeah.
No doubt.
Well, you won it again in '94. You dominated that year. You won 8 of your 16 races. At this point, you're basically on top of the racing world, aren't you? I mean, things could hardly have been going better.
It was wonderful, you know, driving for Roger. That was my first year with Roger. And at Indy, we developed the 209. The Mercedes push rod engine, you know, we definitely had an advantage over the rest of the competitors. And Emerson dominated the race that day, and it was good. It was, I remember going around in the pace car, and Emerson was trying to lap me, and he crashed, trying to put me a lap down. And I remember in the pace car, Dad rode with me in the pace car that year because he had retired. And we came across where Emerson had hit, and I showed Dad where Emerson had hit. And he just looked at me and said very calmly, "It all comes back."
Yeah.
"It all comes back around." And so I knew exactly what he meant.
Yeah.
And so on. And it does at Indy. It all comes back around. And so, that year we had a wonderful year. Seemed like whatever we did, no matter who it was, the engineer or the mechanic or myself, whatever we did to the car, no matter what racetrack we were at, it went faster. And that was all there was to it.
But then in 95, you failed to qualify here. What happened that year?
Everything to the good in 94.
Went the other way.
It went the other way in 95. No matter what we did, no matter who did it, it was the wrong decision to make. And it was the entire team. It just wasn't one guy. It just wasn't me. It just wasn't Emerson. It just wasn't the engineers. It wasn't Roger. I mean, it was everything, just no matter what we did. You know, I remember Emerson ran fast enough to qualify for the race, and Roger waved it off because he didn't feel that it was fast enough to be certainly in the field, okay, to be certain. And so Roger had no choice but to wave it off. You know, you find out the next weekend that, yeah, it would have been fast enough, but it was too close.
Yeah.
It was too competitive that year. I'm making the race, third day of qualifying, I'm making the race, and on the fourth and final lap, I'm in the show, going down the backstretch, the engine blows. It blew up. And those, you know, the engines were good for you know, 600-700 miles. And this engine didn't have that many miles on it. For it to blow up was just a freak deal.
Yeah.
You know, it just, and so no matter what we did, it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah. Again, what goes around comes around. I mean, it all seems to even out in the end, doesn't it?
That's exactly what happened. It truly is. This is hallowed ground.
Yeah.
It truly is. And it can make your career. It can break your career. You know, it's done wonderful things for people who have won it. You know, I can think of an incident in 82, Kevin Cogan on the front row, turns it sideways.
Yeah.
Causes a big, for whatever reason, you know.
Yeah, nobody still knows really what happened.
It could have been a mechanical, no one knows, but it put a black mark on Cogan's career, you
right.
know, and you know, and he was a good driver, he's a smart kid and all that kind of stuff, and so you just never know. Indy is again, you know, I keep saying a very special place.
Unser battles his most difficult opponent when one-on-one continues. But first, here's the call of Unser's 1994 Indianapolis 500 victory over Emerson Fittipaldi, which evened the score from Fittipaldi's win in 1989.
Al Unser Jr. has repassed his teammate, and so Al Unser Jr. is back on the lead lap, but almost a full lap, and for a crash!
Got Emerson Fittipaldi has hit the wall on the inside, coming through four. That means Al Unser pulling away, but Emo, his teammate, hit the wall coming through four, just down below us. He kept it going. It should be in the main straightaway.
Unbelievable. The car comes to a stop just a few feet short of the start-finish line. Emo raises his hands as if to say, I can't believe what has happened. We are 16 laps away from the finish of the 500, and Emerson Fittipaldi is sitting here with the car stalled in the middle of the racetrack without a rear wing.
Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, talking today with Al Unser Jr. He went from racing through life with hardly a care, right smack into a wall of misfortune. The result was a battle with alcohol that cost him plenty. But he turned that into another victory that he relishes today.
You had your bout, I guess you would say, with alcoholism, and to your credit, have been willing to talk about that and help other people with that.
Sure. I mean,
did you find, was it your success that became an obstacle to deal with, or was it frustration that became an obstacle to deal with that might have led you down that path, or was that totally irrelevant? I mean,
it was both.
Yeah.
It was success. It was failure. It was a lot of different things that did it, and quite honestly, none of those things. You know, the disease is very, very unpredictable, and you know, it's very cunning, it's very baffling. but it is a disease. You know, why does one guy get it and somebody else doesn't? And they could drink the same, you know, you just don't know. And so, you know, I definitely went through a lot of hardship in 1999, especially, you know, I got a divorce. And then as soon as a couple months later, after I leave my wife of 17 years, Shelley, my daughter gets put into a wheelchair overnight. You know, came down with transverse myelitis, which is a virus that gets in your spine, and your own immune system goes to kill the virus. It killed part of her spine. So she's playing basketball on a Friday. Her legs go numb. Saturday, she's a paraplegic. It's not a horse accident. She wasn't riding horses. She wasn't in a car accident. I don't think it would matter, but the end of the day, she's a paraplegic, and it was just, you know, if anybody was to get hurt, it would be me. You know, I just didn't understand it, and at that time I had some real issues with God. You know, why? You know, I could not understand it, and so. The only real relief that I found, you know, be all during this time, you've got the split going on.
Right.
See, my life had been spent with all these things geared towards the Indy 500, and I missed the show in 95, and then 96 is the first year of the split. I don't get to come back. 96, I was racing in Michigan.
Yeah.
And I was going down those straightaways at Michigan going, I am in the wrong place. Honest to God. And that morning, I'm on Good Morning America opposite one of my idols, A.J. Foyt, and I'm saying the best drivers in the world are at Michigan and trying to defend what's going on at Michigan when A.J. Foyt, one of my idols, and, you know, it was just bad. It just was not good, okay?
Yeah.
But I had to do it, you know. It was
You're with Cart.
I was with Cart, and I had to do it. And so, you know, I hadn't been to Indy for those years, and really there was a hole inside me that could not be filled, no matter what I did. And then a few years later, I run into my marriage problems, and then, you know, my daughter gets ill. You know, there's so many things that I could blame it on, but it was, at the end of the day, it was meant to be. And I realize that now, and you know, I ended up finally getting a DUI in January 25th of 07, and that's when I had enough. That was it. I had enough. And so asked for help, and I got it, and it was God who took the desire to drink away from me. And so it was asking him for help, and he accomplished what my mom couldn't, my dad couldn't, my friends couldn't, my children could not do, and that was get me to quit drinking, you know, and it was God who did it. And I just, you know, I'm blessed every day to be here, because there is some really crazy times that I honestly shouldn't even be sitting here talking to you, and it's only by the grace of God that I am.
You mean crazy times when you're under the influence of alcohol?
Under the influence of alcohol, yeah. You betcha. There was some, yeah. It was not good, but God saw me through it, and I can honestly say that today it's been a blessing. Now, I wouldn't wish this path on anybody, but where I am today, I'm a better person for it. And so I just I thank God. I wake up every morning and I thank God for me breathing and give me the strength today to do the next right thing. And that's what I try to do, is just do the next right thing. And You know, it's all in God's hands, totally. Mm-hmm.
Did you go through like an Alcoholics Anonymous program, or was it simply something you were able to do on your own?
I went through several programs. not just one. I went through several, it all came down to my relationship with my higher power and that's, you know, God, getting that relationship together is what did it. And
did this happen just at once, at one moment, basically? Was there like an epiphany, or was it?
No, it took a while. It took a while. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And it took help from friends and family, and all that. You know, I mean, a lot of times I called my sister, who unfortunately passed in March of 2009, but she helped me through a lot of periods and so on, and so my sobriety date's 2007, January 25th. And she was a great part of it, and my friends, you know, I could name them, but there's so many of them across the country that truly have helped me and through this disease and continues to help me. You know, I mean, it's a daily process, and so, you know, like I said earlier, I get up every morning and I thank God for having me here, and then I pray to Him to give me the strength and the courage and the wisdom to do the next right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So far, it's worked miracles.
Do you still feel the temptation on occasion to celebrate
with
a drink?
Sure. And, you know, I'm an alcoholic, it comes across you in the weirdest times too. You know, you never even know. You know, quite honestly, one of my weakest times, and it's kind of, I've been sober long enough now that, you know, the desire to drink is less and less and less, but one of the strongest times is actually walking through airports, you know, because I used to walk through airports and you'd get to the show up for the plane about 30-40 minutes or an hour ahead of time, and you know, if it was in the afternoon and, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock or even 7 o'clock at night, you know, you go over and you have a drink, calm the nerves before you get on the plane, and you know, that sort of thing. And when I quit drinking, it was hard to walk by those places, because you'd look in and you'd see everybody in there and they're all having a great time. But like my ex-wife told me, you know, I used up all my coupons. There's nothing left in my coupon book.
It's interesting, because I talked with Rick Mears last year, and he had a similar experience with alcohol. You know, it kind of snuck up on him, and he had to go through Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has a story somewhat like yours. And I think to the casual race fan, you two would be like the least likely suspects for that, because, you know, Rick was always as calm as could possibly be. You appeared to be so happy-go-lucky, and everybody, you know, little Al was just always the cute kid racing, and it just shows how you just don't know. I mean, it could sneak up on anybody.
It can sneak up on anybody, and, you know, if you know a loved one who's having any issues with alcohol, find out about it. Find out about the disease. Call up. You know, there's plenty of websites. There's lots of AA around. There's lots of rehab centers. You just make phone calls and learn about the disease. And because it just, you're not just talking about the alcoholic. It's anybody who walks in or touches his life is affected, or her life is affected by this disease. It's extremely hard on the spouse and the siblings. It's untold misfortunes that go on from this disease, and so it's not just the alcoholic. And so if your friend, you see your friend having any kind of issues with alcohol, talk to him or her. And don't be afraid of it. You know, it's something that it's a disease, and that's all it is. And there's cancer, there's diabetes, there's all kinds of different diseases out there that have medicines that taken can put it into remission and so on, serious diseases, and so you take your medicine, and that's the same way with alcoholism. You know, there is medicine out there for it, and it comes through the power of God, and it comes through people helping other people. And that's the medicine. That truly is the medicine, is just offering assistance, and if you do it enough, you know, that person, whether it a him or a her, they'll think about it and they'll keep thinking about it, and they'll go, you know, I can tell you, sober life, I feel better today than I did when I was 20. Absolutely. And I'm in better shape than I was. Now, not my shape, but
your internal shape.
My internal shape, my mind and everything, you know, my legs, everything is in way better because I work out and I love working out, and it's something that you know, I never really did in my 20s and 30s. And I think mainly because I didn't have to.
Yeah.
But, you know, now I'm in my upper 40s. Yeah, I need to work out. And when I do and I go to the gym, I come out of there and I feel great. It just happened to me yesterday. I'd been back here from last week and I hadn't had a chance to go work out. And I finally got to the gym yesterday and I came out of there and I felt like $1 million, mm-hmm. you know, and I was only in there 45 minutes, but it was long enough to make me feel good.
And yeah. Did alcohol ever impact your driving career? Did you ever like compete in a race maybe when you were a little hungover or something like that? Or,
well, I competed in races that sure, I drank the night before, and not excessively or anything like that. But when you talk about years of drinking, it builds up. Yeah, there was tests, you know, that on a Wednesday that, you know, I was out drinking on Tuesday night and so on, and, you know, didn't get to bed as early as I should have and that sort of thing, and go out and, you know, not be as sharp as I could have been, you know, and so on. And so I don't think, honestly, I don't think it had anything to do with the results. Like when you add up my numbers of races that I won through my whole career, okay, because there was races that I won that I shouldn't have won, and there was races that I lost that I should have won, you know, outright, where, you know, engines blow up on the last lap, I'm leading the race, and, you know, someone else goes and wins. Same thing would happen if I'm running second and the leader, his engine blows up and I win, you know, and a lot of that happened. I don't think the results would have changed, but what I feel would have changed was my enjoyment of doing it. That would have changed. Because I would have been more alert, I would have been able to soak in every moment of it, and really, that's what life's about. Is we've got today, you know, tomorrow's not here yet, yesterday's gone. We've got now. We've got this moment, and we're never going to get this moment back. And so, if I could have been sharper in my life when I was living these moments, I would have remembered them better and I would have enjoyed them better. And so that's what not drinking has given me, is, you know, I know the difference now and I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Were you a beer drinker or something else? Did you have a choice?
It didn't matter. Are you
anything?
Kidding?
Whatever was available.
I drank anything, you know.
Hunter's racing career grinds to a halt, but he gets a new one with the IRL and starts working on a dream as well, when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with Al Unser Jr. He stepped away from his driving career quietly, and now he's back working with young drivers and preparing to make another dream come true.
So now you are basically a driving instructor for the IRL, right?
I wouldn't say an instructor. Okay. I'd, you know, when the IRL first started, there was a lot of young kids that had not been to Indy before, and so they needed a coach and they needed some instructions, you know. And so Rutherford and my dad were brought on as driver coaches to coach the kids along, you know, and because there was so many of them that really hadn't run on an oval before. And so the position was invented. It was needed. That position was needed. And quite honestly, you know, I was very fortunate when I was a rookie to have my father to go to that I could honestly trust and so on. But my dad, when he was a rookie, he didn't have anybody to go to. And then you know, the guys in you know, that I was racing against, like Scott Brayton or Ari Lyandike or Steve Krisloff. I mean, these guys, they didn't have anybody to go to, mm-hmm. you know. And so it's a definite benefit to have this experience that you can tap into that's not a competitor. He's not your teammate, you know, and that sort of thing. He's not going to go out there and race you. So you can honestly believe in what he's telling you. Also, on race day, we're up in race control and helping Brian Barnhart with, you know, seeing a guy that's, you know, he's pushing the rules just a little bit on his driving. He's moving around a little bit too much. Or he comes in and makes a pit stop, and say he runs over an air hose or he comes in a little bit too hot and knocks a tire out into the, you know, did he do it on purpose? Was he trying to gain an advantage by clipping it too close to another competitor, or did he do it on accident? You know, and so judgment has to come into these calls. And so Brian and Bill Van de Zandt and Tony Kottman, who are doing it today, they've never driven race cars. They've never been in the heat of the moment in driving these things. And so, you know, I have, and my dad has. And so my dad was up in race control giving advice. And so when my dad decided to that the traveling was getting a little bit too much, which was at the end of 08, the position was offered to me, and it was a true blessing. It was something that I think, quite honestly, my sobriety had a lot to do with it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that I could be trusted and so on, and my heart was in it. That's what it's actually turned out to be, is a true blessing. And so I've actually have slid into the same spot my dad was in. And so I'm still following my father's footsteps, which I'm very proud of, by the way. You know,
sure.
I'm very proud to do that.
Was it hard for you to retire? Like most drivers, you just kind of faded away. You know, there's not like a grand finale. There's not a banquet, you know, or whatever. You just kind of stop one day, right?
Yeah, you do. I mean, most drivers do. I mean, now Mario had a farewell tour, and I think Richard Petty had one too. No, I mean, it was in 04, and I was at Richmond, and I wasn't competitive, and I wasn't truly loving what I was doing. And when that day came, you know, my dad and I had talked about it, you know, if you don't get out of the car, you're going to end up hurting yourself or hurting someone else. If your heart's not in it, then don't be in that car. And so my heart wasn't in it anymore, and I got out. And so I didn't think I was going to miss it. And so the 05 Indy came rolling around, and there I was yelling at the TV and all that kind of stuff.
Were you in Albuquerque?
And I was in Henderson, Nevada at the time. I was in Vegas. Yeah, no, I missed it.
Yeah.
I missed the Indy 500. I didn't miss anything else, but I did miss the Indy 500. And so I came back in 06, and then AJ offered me a ride in 07, okay? And even with the problems that I had and all that kind of stuff, you know, AJ believed that that I was definitely capable of doing it, and I still felt I could do it too, you know. And so, you know, we ran the 07 Indy 500, and at the end of that race, you know, I went, you know, truly, my heart's truly not in this. And so that was it. That was mm-hmm. when I got out.
And you're 49, and your dad was how old when he won his fourth?
48.
Yeah, he's the oldest winner.
Yeah.
So is there part of you that thinks, I could still be doing this if I wanted to?
No. It's a different era. It's a different formula of car that they're out there driving today. And so, no, it's you got to be driving these cars. The competition is so close. The cars are so reliable. And no one's going to fall out there. You know, mechanicals are very far and few between. You know, the only time anybody really falls out of this race is when they run into each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. rather be on pit lane or the track, they run into each other. And that's the only time really the cars break down. And so, you know, when in the 80s, that wasn't the case. It was a different era.
Do you expect that one or both of your sons will race here one day?
I hope to. You know, I hope that that both my sons race here. You know, I really feel that racing is a science and it can be taught. Now, what can't be taught is that desire within yourself, you know, because there's going to be times that you got to go out there and you got to lay it on the line. And what I mean by that, your life. You gotta just go out there and just put it out there. And that's going to be up to them, up to my boys. That's going to be up to them. But I would love to give them an opportunity. And quite honestly, it's something that I never thought about during my career, and that's owning a team.
Mm.
I never thought about that. You know, the Unsers have never owned their Indy cars back here. And so we've always driven for somebody else. And so I never really gave it much thought what I do after racing. Because quite honestly, I didn't think I was going to make it this far. You know, I honestly didn't. And
you mean as a driver, you didn't think you would live this long?
I didn't. That wow. is correct. You know, because of the nature of the business that
wow.
I'm in. And during my career, I'm willing to lay it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, more than once. I mean, like, mm-hmm. hundreds of times, not just a little. And so every time I got in that car, I gave it my all. And being smart about it, you know, now there's...
Yeah, you weren't reckless, you were
no,
just...
No, that's right.
Courageous.
Not being reckless, but being smart about it. But there's mechanical failures. You know, the driver can be doing what he's doing in a mechanical failure, and he would no longer be with us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the ugly side of our sport.
Sure.
You know, it truly is. And so I really didn't plan on it. And so now that I'm here and all that kind of stuff, and I've got my life together, and honestly, my best days are still in front of me. They're not behind me, and I've had some really good days.
Yes, you have.
Behind me.
Yeah.
And my best days are in front of me, and, you know, I couldn't think of anything better than for one of my two boys or a driver of mine to win the Indy 500. That would be bigger than my own wins. And
yeah.
So I'm wanting to own a team. I'm working very hard on raising sponsorship, finding partners that I could go out and partner up with and win the Indy 500.
You really thought you might lose your life in a racing accident, huh? Was that partly because of your family history? Like, well, this is...
No, because actually my family history is very safe.
Overall, with your dad and uncle,
overall,
sure.
That's right. And as the technology of the cars, they got safer and safer and safer.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
So most of my career, yeah, I wasn't thinking about, you know, I was thinking about winning the race this weekend. I wasn't thinking about, well, you know, when I'm 49 years old or when I'm 45 years old and I don't want to drive race cars anymore, which will never come because I love racing.
Yeah.
And I couldn't think about not driving a car.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the what we talked about earlier, if your heart's not in it, I never imagined my heart not being in racing. My heart's never left racing. It's just in a different place. That's what's actually happened now that I'm here. It's what's actually happened. It was, you know, my heart was driving. My heart became not so much interested in driving anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had done everything, and I had done it not once, but twice. You know, the IROCs, the Daytonas, the Indies, the national championships, you know, the Long Beaches, the Torontos, the Milwaukees, all of these races, you know, the sprint cars, the go-karts when I was nine, you know, I mean,
yeah.
I'd been racing every summer since I was 9 years old, and it was all about driving. You know, I never gave it the thought, and I wished I would have, which... had I done better in school, I would have.
There we go.
I mean, there would have been a business side to it.
Yeah.
But there never was a business side to it. It was all just pure driving and racing. And so, yeah, now I want to own a team and all that.
Unser talks about his literal dreams when he's sleeping at night, including the horrifying dream that haunted him throughout his racing career, when One-on-One continues. We are back on One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Al Unser Jr. is keeping his racing dreams alive as a prospective car owner, but some of the dreams from his past were truly frightening and revealed a hidden fear. He'll explain.
I have a theme question I've asked everybody. Do you, when you're sleeping at night, dream of racing? Like, I've asked basketball players, do they dream that they're still playing, that kind of thing? Like Larry Bird will have recurring dreams occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have dreams that you're in a race anymore?
The answer's yes.
Do you?
Yeah.
What's happening?
I do have dreams. It all depends. Yeah. There's a lot of times that I'm driving the Valvoline car. There's a lot of times that I'm driving the Marlboro car. There's weird things going on. Sometimes I'm, and I don't know why, but I'm late for the start of a race.
Yeah.
You know, I'm late, which I never was in my whole life. And you can't be, okay? there's weird dreams. I haven't had one for a very long time.
But
the answer is yes.
That's interesting. I hear other people say that too, like, they are late to get to the game, or I've talked to a broadcaster who says he'll get there and forget his equipment or stuff like that. It seems like everybody has that little dream where they're running late or they forget something or whatever.
I honestly don't know what that is.
You know?
I mean, because I've asked, as a matter of fact, it was a topic that was brought up between Gordon Johncock and myself.
Mm.
And Gordon said the same thing.
Yeah.
That he was late getting in the car, that the race would like start without him, and he's going and I'm going, I have that same thing.
I bet a lot of guys do. Did you win races in your dreams? When you were still racing, or?
Yeah, I won races even when I was racing. There was an occurring dream that I had lost my legs.
Wow.
You know, there was an occurring dream that I had lost my legs.
That you're in an accident and lost your legs in a race.
Lost my legs in a race, yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah. I didn't have that one a lot, but yeah, during my career I had that one.
Yeah.
After my career was over, it came about being late.
That's much better. Better to be late. So. But we should mention your charity work. You mentioned your daughter who had... the spinal disease, and now you're involved with the, correct me if I'm wrong, a race clinic for paralysis?
Actually, it's the Cody Unser First Step Foundation.
Okay,
is my daughter's foundation, and she's involved in a lot of different fundraisers and so on. They just got back from doing a scuba diving trip with paralyzed veterans, and so that's very, very important to her and so on. You know, there's the Miami Project that I truly love to give to. There's John Hopkins is one of the leaders in transverse myelitis, you know, and that has to do with my daughter's illnesses and so on. Another strong foundation I'm heavily involved with is Make-A-Wish Foundation, and that goes across the board. You know, that's taken, you know, these kids who don't have very long to live and making their wish come true, and that means an awful lot to me also.
Yeah. So. Do you have any particular racing regrets? Is there like one particular race you look back on and think, God, I'd like to have that one over? Or maybe I should have pursued NASCAR more or something like that?
Today you can look back and go, wow, I wish I would have pursued NASCAR more because they're raking in the dough. I mean, they're making so much money over there and so on. But no, I truly loved the open wheel car, the single seat open wheel car. And no, I don't regret not going to NASCAR. You know, I definitely could have done it. I loved driving them.
You did what? One race, right?
I did one race at the Daytona 500 in 93, but it was a restrictor plate race. But the IROC cars, we raced in different places and I truly enjoyed that. I got to race Dale Sr. Him and I had some real good ones, and Mark Martin and you know, Darrell Waltrip and all these great race car drivers. I could have done it, and so on. But the sheer performance of this single seat open wheel car, the way it goes around the corner, the way it accelerates, the way it brakes, it's phenomenal. And so I thought about the Wednesday test. Do I want to be driving a very exotic race car, or do I want to be driving a car that doesn't have the performance level that single seat does? You know, because a race car is a race car, and it's all relative. And I've driven enough different race cars to know that, you know, I mean, it's hard to race in the elite and win a World of Outlaws show. It's hard to go and win the Chili Bowl in a midget. It's hard. And so it's hard to go win a cup race or the NASCAR Truck Series or the Nationwide, you know, it's hard to, because when you're talking those levels, and the top five or top 10 guys, they do it all the time, and they're dead serious, and they know what they're doing. And so it's hard to do that. And so I don't want to say that one's better than the other, but when I'm on a Wednesday and I'm developing a race car, I want it to be one that I have a lot of tools to play with, wings, ground effects. You know, this is in addition to springs and shocks and cambers and cross weight. You know, they call it wedge in NASCAR, okay? I've got all these things that I can play with to develop and make this race car go faster around the corner than it did when I got in it that morning. And so that is what excited me. And so that's why I didn't go to NASCAR, is because of that Wednesday when there's no one in the grandstands and all that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I could have made a lot more money, you know, and I had my opportunities. You know, I drove for Rick Hendricks and it was great, and had conversations with a lot of the car owners down there, you know, that exist today. You know, but it wasn't where my heart was. My heart was at the Indy 500,
and
always has been. And so, you know, there's the 24 hours of Le Mans. You know, that would be a great one to win, you know, or be a great one to even race in, let alone win it, but to race in it. You know, Monaco would be a super race to be in, but it wasn't meant to be, and it wasn't my destiny, and that kind of thing. And so, what has happened in my life is what has been meant to be, and I accept it as that.
One-on-One with Al Unser Jr. continues in a moment. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Well, a double thanks to Al Unser Jr. for being so cooperative that he forced me to air two episodes of his story. No way I could have gotten everything into one and still done it justice. The racing career is one thing, a big thing, but he obviously had a lot more worth talking about. And of course, as always, if you missed any part of the episodes with Little Al or want to hear any of the other conversations from the series, all you got to do is go to 1070thefan.com, click on Shows, click on One-on-One, and look for the podcast. I've talked with five former race winners now, along with Donald Davidson and Tom Carnegie, and not to mention an endless stream of personalities from other sports. You can reach me by email at mark@1070thefan, and I'll be back next week with yet another spine-tingling conversation right here on 1070 The Fan.